Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
So I'd rather have old as shit as opposed to crazy as fuck sitting down in 1600.
But Michael, why should Democratic voters settle for my guy is better than the other guy? They should be able to find somebody that they can put out there that shares their values that is like, you know, gangbusters.
Well, that's why I said 2023 was so important. First off, your messaging is all off to begin with. Second of all, you've got a candidate that doesn't want to move on, but yet everyone around him knows he should. And nobody has figured out, A, how to deal with that, B, how to deal with Kamala, and C, more importantly, putting forward a candidate who could then stand up against Trump in a way in which you could actually hold those seven battleground states.
Yeah, and we report in this book how Biden, his people were trying to undermine Kamala Harris. I mean, they were sending notes to donors, emails, basically saying, if you kick him out of the race, you're going to be left with her.
Biden is drowning Harris in order to keep his head above water when it's clear to everyone else he's not going to make it downriver.
So the 2024 presidential election was one America absolutely dreaded, a rematch between two of the oldest men ever to serve as president. But what began as a predictable contest soon became one of the most head-turning races in American history. In the span of, just amazing, just a few months, Joe Biden dropped out of the race, Donald Trump faced felony convictions, survived an assassination attempt, and Kamala Harris was unexpectedly thrust into the spotlight, all while mounting an unprecedented campaign for the presidency. That was wild. So today I'm joined by best-selling authors Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes to discuss their new book, Fight, Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. Jonathan Allen is an award-winning political reporter at NBC News, who I've known for 25 years. He previously worked as the Washington Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News and as the White House Bureau Chief for Politico. Amy Parnes is no slouch, folks. She's the real deal, senior political correspondent covering national politics at The Hill. She previously worked as a staff writer at Politico, and during the first Trump administration, she was a CNN political analyst. She's the co-author of three books with Jonathan Allen, including the New York Times bestsellers HRC and Shattered. So settle back, grab a little something, and join me for an incredibly fun conversation coming up next right here on the Michael Steele podcast. You don't want to miss this one. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. You know you are in the house because this is the safest place you can be right now because the streets are fucked up with a lot of stuff that Trump and Elon are doing. But the resistance, if you will, is there. We'll get into conversations with our guests about what happened over the last few days with protests around the country. I think as we're looking at the fights, figuratively speaking, on our streets, you also have our guests who've written a book about the fights inside the White House. Welcome, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. It's so great to have you guys here with me.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, so folks, just for those of you who are in your cars listening to this, I just want a scene set for you that my brother John, whom I've known a very, very long time, is clearly on a deck somewhere outside enjoying the sun. And at any moment, there will be a cigar that will come into view. So I'm just letting everybody... Amy's like, yes, I've been in that space where it's just a smoke.
Well, now that it's been offered up as a, you know, now I'm gonna light it.
There it is, my man.
This is how he does all his interviews, by the way, Michael. Did you know this?
It's excellent. Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, like I said, this brother has been in the game. He knows how to play it.
It's my nice fancy $6 cigar.
Hey, that's not bad. $6 cigar. Mine are usually $1.99. That's not bad.
Well, I'm not going the full Swisher Sweets route, Michael.
Okay.
But I have before, and I've definitely packed a Philly blunt with some stuff before. So, but this one's just tobacco.
Well, we appreciate it. So, of course, folks, just so you know, again, for those of you who aren't seeing this, Amy's got this look on her face that Mika has when Joe starts talking about sports. And Joe and the fellas start getting into it. We're doing the cigar thing, but so, Amy, we'll be good.
Okay.
We'll be good.
All right.
We'll be good. You guys have a great new book out. It is one of the top leaders on Amazon right now. Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. Just if you could scene set for us what the book is about, what the narratives that you touch on, because, you know, I think a lot of folks, you know, at a certain point go, you know, yeah, okay, it's another, you know, Trump story. But this one is different. This one has, I think, a bit more edge to it. It is much more of the background around a lot of the noise that you see play out on the streets. And while there may be this forward-facing, you know, sort of uniformity to the attack, that's not necessarily how it plays out inside the building itself.
No, and I think what we aim to do here, Michael, is to give you a 360 view, as you say, into the campaigns, both of them. There was so much that happened. That's why John and I jumped in to do this book to begin with. We weren't going to do another book. And then, you know, the debate happens, the disastrous debate. There are two attempted assassinations on Trump. There's a candidate switch that happens. And so we all know the story of what happens, but do we really know? And so we take you inside the room. We open up the entire book inside Nancy Pelosi's living room, watching the debate unfold. Mm-hmm. Intentionally, obviously, she's there alone. Jim Clyburn, another Democratic leader, watching the debate alone, having a drink. Al Sharpton also watching the debate alone. We take you inside and show you what is happening to, you know, her. Nancy Pelosi's fielding all these text messages from donors and lawmakers, and what happens over the course of those 24 days before the candidate switch. And our goal here was to basically not just look back, but look forward and have a guide of sorts for both parties as they're navigating the next couple of years.
If I could just jump in here for a minute, Michael, and piggyback on what Amy was saying, I think what's really important in this book, and it gets a lot of attention for sort of the juicy behind the scenes, you know, peeling back the curtain. If you love that stuff, and political junkies do, and I'm sure a lot of folks listening to this and watching it do, it has all that stuff. But I think one of the really important things here is it has a lot of lessons for not just Democratic leaders, but really Democratic voters about what they need to be looking for in their candidates, what they need to be looking for in the people that are running their campaigns, what they need to demand of them. We go inside Kamala Harris's house on election night in the vice president's residence. And you as a reader experience this with her, this incredible shock that she's losing. She thought going into election day that she was going to win. The people around her told her that she was poised to win. David Plouffe, her senior advisor on her campaign, said that she was going to win all seven swing states, and she was prepared for that. And I think Democratic voters across the country were also prepared for that. They were listening to the same people, the same leadership of that campaign, and were shocked and you know, befuddled by what happened. And we take you through Kamala Harris and her thinking on election night as she goes to bed and just can't figure out why it was that she was in this position of being shocked, of being, mm-hmm. You know, of not knowing that this was, you know, the outcome that was going to happen, and ultimately feeling, you know, that she had been gaslit too. And I think that there were a lot of Democrats that felt that on election night, that felt that their leaders were not straight with them about where Joe Biden stood in terms of his ability to run, and that were not straight with them about where the campaign stood.
That's such a fascinating point, because it's intriguing to me that almost like 2016, where they completely miss the read, yeah, that you're going to tell the nominee you're going to win all seven battleground states and then get clocked.
Exactly.
And you're like, well, what didn't they see? What didn't the leadership team, the DNC, the DCCC, the senatorial committee of the DSC, what did they not see? What did her advisors not see? Before we get into the whole thing with Biden and what he should have done or shouldn't have done, you look at the race itself, there were elements that were very clear that this was going to be a tough race, a closer race than maybe folks were projecting or thinking. And yeah, a lot of us thought that the elements, the fundamentals were in place for her to have a victory. I never thought she'd win all seven battleground states, but I didn't think she'd get cleaned out in all seven of them either.
So I think there were a lot of things that were missed, and you know, you can look at the sort of numerical level, right? You can look at the, you know, where was the positioning of the horse race piece of it, and again, you've got a Democratic campaign that is running its strategy based on data analytics, based on, and every campaign at that level should have sophisticated data. The question is, are you strategizing based on the data, or are you incorporating the data into your strategy? And I'll give you an example of where data seemed to do them really wrong. The trans ad that Donald Trump ran about Kamala Harris supporting state-subsidized transgender surgeries for illegal immigrants in prison. That most of us, we heard that the first time and thought, there's no way. Like, that's some sort of made up. And in fact, that's what she supported. And that's fine. But I think the strategic error for the Democrats, or tactical error at least, was they didn't respond. And they were getting that campaign was getting all kinds of incoming from, you know, folks who have an understanding, a sort of gut level understanding of politics, that ad was extremely effective.
Yeah.
And Kamala Harris needed to respond. In fact, one of them was Bill Clinton. He was out doing campaign events. He's on a rope line, or on rope lines, and he's watching TV when he's, you know, at night, and he's seeing this ad come in. He's hearing about it on the rope lines, and he calls up everyone he can think of to call up to say, hey, we got to respond to this. And eventually the campaign responds to him and says, no, we've done some ad testing, and our analytics on our ad testing say that ad isn't that effective, and moreover, the types of responses we've tried aren't very effective, so we're just kind of let it go. And Bill Clinton's beside himself. He's like, you can't let a charge like that go. Right? I mean, we all heard the tagline of that ad, Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you, and realized immediately that was going to be an effective ad, especially playing for male audiences on pretty much every sportscast over the course of the last couple of years.
Probably the best political ad that I've seen in a while.
Oh, and, undoubtedly.
And, you know, Trump saw it, and he saw a private screening of it, obviously, on Trump Force One with Chris Lacivita, his advisor, as we report in the book. And he looked at it, and he thought it was almost perfect. And one thing he wanted to do was he wanted to cut out a clip of Erin Burnett from CNN. And, in fact, in that clip, she was saying that the fact check was true, that what was being said in the ad was true, and he still was like, I don't want Erin Burnett in my But that was the only change that they made. And because it was so effective, and that's just one small example. And I think if you are a Democratic voter, you got to wonder who it is that, you know, is making these calls. And you can read about it in the book, that, you know, the individuals who are part of it, but also the kind of groupthink that develops around these data points that can lead you in sort of crazy directions if you don't use the data instead of letting the data use you.
Amy, how did they get that so wrong? I mean, it's, in my estimation, and a number of us were on some of these calls and meetings with Democrats, trying to help guide them to understand that they are in the corner of the room and the country's in the center of the room, right?
Yeah.
In fact, not only are they in the center of the room, but they're starting to leave the room.
Yeah.
And how did they not read that? How did they get that so incredibly wrong in not understanding? I mean, this, folks, is just as John says, a very small piece of a bigger puzzle,
yeah,
which has many more pieces to it. But for me, this ad, as someone who knows how to cut an ad and knows how to sell an idea, if you doubt me, go back to 2010. The reality of it is that ad kicked ass.
Oh yeah,
you didn't have to do anything else.
No,
after that ad. And the reason, folks, is because it, to Jonathan's point, it cut to the core, Amy, mm-hmm, of where the country was on a cultural issue that transcended school books and CRT, that transcended, you know, the economy and the price of eggs,
yeah,
because it went to the heart of how people felt about this idea of my daughter going into a bathroom and finding a boy dressed as a girl in that bathroom. That's the, you may disagree with that, you may be offended by what I just said, but guess what? The country wasn't and still isn't.
Yeah. I mean, they went too far, I think, is the short answer, right? That they didn't really understand and connect with voters, which was also the problem in 2016, as you mentioned earlier. You know, this is a problem. They have gone so far off course. They have lost their identity. They don't know who they are at this point. And that's why you see them sort of lost in the wilderness right now, because they don't have an identity. They have too many ideas almost, and they haven't homed in on one or two, which was Hillary Clinton's problem as well. And, you know, you tie that into another ad they ran about Kamala Harris appearing on The View and saying yes, that she wouldn't do anything differently. Those two ads
that's
together.
A bookend. That's a bookend.
Yes. Yeah. Completely. I mean, they were trying to find a way to do that, and she did the talking for them. And then, boom, two ads, right? They could have played those two ads all the, you know, the rest of the, and they did, and they could have won just based on those two ads.
So as I said, this book is a very interesting insight, because as a lot of books out there want to give sort of the insight about Trump's journey back to the White House, and you do get into that. This really does kind of cut into some of the interesting backstories on the Democratic side, starting with the late spring, after the debate, early summer, and the Democrats are sitting there watching this debate with Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and there's crap all over the floor, and it ain't from Trump, and they watch the old guy not only piss his pants but poop his pants in a way politically that many thought was devastatingly bad. I had a slightly different perspective on that. I didn't react the way a lot of people did, because what I paid attention to, unlike a lot of folks in this town who care more about what each other is thinking and how they're reacting, meaning the political and media establishments whose hair was on fire to the point that it was almost laughable. But I was looking at grandma in Missouri, or cousin Ellie in Pennsylvania, or neighbor Susie in Florida. And you know what I found? He wasn't losing his base after that debacle. His base, in fact, tightened around him, particularly among African Americans. So again, in the category of how the hell did we miss that? What didn't people see versus what they saw or wanted to see coming out of that debate?
I think one of the things, Michael, is that Democratic voters were conditioned a little bit by Donald Trump accusing Biden of having lost it long before 2024. Yeah. Even as early as 2020, and Democrats responding, you know, Democratic leaders responding and saying there's nothing wrong with him at all. He hasn't really lost a step. And I think so at some level, I think if you're the average voter and you're listening to your party leaders and what they're saying and you're reacting to what the other side is saying, it becomes very easy to, you know, to sort of dig in the trenches and be loyal with your team. You know, I thought that my personal view of the debate, and I don't often talk about my personal views, but I thought it was scary. I thought the leader of the free world having even if that was his worst moment, having that kind of lostness was a little scary. And I think that was something that was shocking to a lot of people, even as they supported him. I think there were a lot of people that continued to support Joe Biden who said, look, I don't care. He's not Donald Trump. Like he's a more moral man. He's, you know, more clear-minded in their view. And Donald Trump is going to be a disaster. And so what? So what? Like Donald Trump's a bad guy in their mind. Joe Biden's a good guy. And Joe Biden has a better chance of beating Trump than anybody else, which is what Biden and the White House were telling everyone, even though he was trailing Trump significantly, as we report in the book. And the people closest to him knew that. It's one of the reasons that they decided to try to have a debate early was because they wanted to shake up the trajectory of the race, which they did, just not.
That's about the only thing they got right.
Yeah, not in the manner they desired. It's one of the reasons I say if you read this book as a reader, as somebody who's invested and engaged in politics, but you're not somebody who has the big power at the top, you will see all of the crazy things that went on behind the scenes of these people backstabbing each other, trying to, in a lot of cases, losing sight of what the goal was for the Democratic Party, which was to stop Donald Trump, whether that was at the expense of Joe Biden or at the expense of Nancy Pelosi or at the expense of any of these people or of their relationships. Their North Star should have been, got to figure out how to win. And I think some of them lost sight of that. And I think if you're a Democratic voter and the Democratic Party is out of power, or if you're an independent that leans Democrat, but had trouble with them this year, I think if you look at all of the behind the scenes stuff, the reason that it's important is it gives you an idea of what you need to be demanding from your leaders.
Yeah.
If there's going to be change at the top, and there needs to be change at the top of the way that Democrats run campaigns, if they want to not just win every once in a while, but actually win in a way that they have, you know, the power to govern effectively. They're going to have to change up a lot of stuff. There was no Democratic message this year. It was, you know, went from Biden saying that everything was fine and his economy was great. And the economy is nuanced and complex, but people were worried about inflation and they were worried about tomorrow. And the White House seemed, Biden seemed dismissive of that. And then you get to the Kamala Harris campaign, and she's basically like, there's no difference between me and Biden except for our backgrounds. And, you know, for a voter.
If I don't want to vote for Biden, why should I vote for you if you're no different?
Right, exactly. And so, you know, I mean, I think, look, if you're a Democratic candidate, if you're a Republican candidate, whoever is running for president, you basically got to tell people that you understand what it is they want, tell them how you're going to give it to them, and explain why you're better than the other side to give it to them. And I think the Biden campaign did not do that in 2024. I think he did it pretty well in 2020. He didn't do it well in 2024. And the inherited Harris campaign was not able to come up with a new strategy, like Amy was saying on The View. She said she couldn't think of anything she would have done.
Right. Amy, you guys note in the book, quote, but for many Democrats around the country, even professional political operatives who supported Biden, the debate was the first incontrovertible evidence that his worst moments were so awful. At least Democrats hope this is rock bottom, maybe. The people closest to Biden would never cop to complicity of their own silence, none of them wanted to take the blame for their collective neglect. What many Democratic voters didn't grasp at the time was that Biden was already on track to lose, and the highest ranking party insiders were well aware of that. He had won by a comfortable popular vote majority in 2020, with more than 7 million votes separating him from Trump, which led his supporters to believe he had cruised to victory.
And that's not true, as we wrote about in our last book, Lucky.
He did get lucky. And look, that 2020 campaign for me was one in which I think, to the broader point that both of you've made so far, that the target had to be Trump. It couldn't be anything else. You didn't have time to sit down and worry about the nuances of X, Y, and Z. This was all hands on decks, alarm fires, alarm bells going. And 24 was actually more of that. But this underlying piece that you guys level up early on in the book, I think fundamentally sort of set the trajectory of the campaign. But I want to go back before that, Amy.
Okay.
Because in my thinking, in 2023, mm-hmm. after the State of the Union address, which was a very good, well-delivered address.
Yeah.
You see the president engaging Republicans, putting them back on the hill, scoring political points, real time. And
Social Security, there was that battle, the give and take.
Yes, yeah. Beautifully done.
Yeah.
That's the moment you go to the president and say, sir, you're not running in 24.
If I'm
the party chairman, I go to the senior leadership and say, this was wonderful. But this we know the background here. We know the underlying truths of, you know, getting up for one game, right?
Yeah.
When you've got 24 more in front of you,
right,
over the next 2 years. So why didn't they? Why didn't the Democratic leadership, who later betrayed their relationship with the president, just to put it as bluntly as I can, Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, go to him in 23 and said, we know you said you want to be a transitional president, and you have been.
Yeah.
And so we're now prepared to move on. I have a thought, but I want to hear why you think they didn't.
Well, it seems like no one wanted to cross him. Like his team was so convinced, you know, first of all, he wanted to win and he was dead set on doing that. And then, you know, his team also didn't want to cross him. And they pointed to, you know, the fact that he had successes, some legislative victories. They mm-hmm. felt like he had a good first term and that he could successfully run on it. But once again, they were sort of blind to the bigger picture and were missing certain elements of what the electorate, I think, really wanted. That was a huge blind spot, I think, for them. And I think that's why a lot of people are, you know, shooting arrows in his direction and his team's direction right now. You know, someone told us that Mike Donilon said, you don't walk away from the plane. You don't walk away from the house and the chopper. This was a guy and his, I believe Jill Biden as well, you know, got used to living at the White House. He always wanted to be president. He was finally president. He didn't want to walk away. He felt like he had earned the right to be there and to run again.
Okay.
I would just add to that.
Okay. I look, there are a lot of things I want to be and feel I've earned, but reality is a bitch.
No, but I would love to hear your view on this because you said.
So, yes. So my theory on this boils down to two words. Kamala Harris.
Right.
What do you do with a problem like Kamala Harris? Now you need to hear that in the tunes of what do you do with a problem like Maria, right? From Southern Music. I'm a theater kid. What can I say? But really, that was that at the end of the day is their underlying problem.
Yeah.
They have a black woman sitting up there on Mass Avenue in the house at the observatory as the vice president of the United States, and they did not want to have to deal with her. They did not want her to be their nominee. They did not think that she could win. And they were not prepared to do anything to make sure that that fortune turned around so that she could win. Because there were a whole lot of folks who had ambitions, partly laid out in the conversation with Governor Shapiro and trying to bring him onto the ticket. He was like, oh, no, that's all right. I'm good. Because I want the job you're seeking. I'm not going to be your number two. It takes me out of play. He ain't stupid. Yeah. And Gavin, all this leveling up Gavin Newsom, oh, let's have an open convention. Oh, let's have a short primary. All of these things were pieces that underscored the narrative that they had a problem, that Joe Biden put them in an awkward position. And even on the day he resigned, the idea of running for the presidency, there was that, 3-hour gap? Because I remember it happened right as we were ending our show on the weekend, that the president comes out with this announcement that he's not going to run. And then by 1 or 2 o'clock, he says, oh, and by the way, I'm endorsing the Black woman, in which case is hair on fire. So that's kind of my thinking, that really what sort of gummed up a lot of the movement to get Joe out of the race is that they had a sitting vice president that no one knew what to do with.
I think you're very right about that, Michael, at least in terms of the Democratic leadership. Not, you know, the first thing I would say is somebody who spoke to Nancy Pelosi right after the debate in June said that her initial response was that she was worried that the bum rush to get rid of Biden would go so fast that Harris would be inserted, and that they, you know, she had to try to stop that from happening. She did not have any faith in Kamala Harris. Barack Obama had this, like, you know, fantasy baseball open convention idea going that he was pushing. And we report in the book for the first time, actually, what happened between Biden and Harris when they did the handoff. So he calls her up and he says, listen, I'm going to get out. And she says, are you sure? You know, don't let him push you out. And he said, no, I'm sure. And then and he says, I've got a statement ready to go. And she goes, well, are you going to endorse me? And he says, you've got my support, kid. And she said, I see you laughing, Michael, because you've been part of these discussions before. And like, and basically she's like, that's not an endorsement.
No, and
Joe Biden's got all these delegates to the convention, and Barack Obama wants an open convention, and Nancy Pelosi wants an open convention. And she's like, if you don't endorse me, everybody's going to see that as a rejection of me. And it's going to go somewhere else. Like, this is the moment. And if you don't endorse me, you're going to be telling everybody you made the wrong choice of picking me as your vice presidential candidate way back when. And of course, like, Biden actually, like, what he wants to do is take a few days, because he wants to do like this kind of like victory lap where he praises himself for being like George Washington and giving up power voluntarily. So he says to her, you know, maybe Thursday I'll endorse you. And she's like, not Thursday. Like, this is all going to go down today. And so finally he says, well, you're making some good points. Let me call you back. And he gets with his guys and she gets with her guys and she writes up a statement for him. And he gets back on the phone with her. And he says, all right, we're going to do two statements today. One is my statement. We'll let that sit for a while. And then you'll get your statement. And she's like thinking like, okay, like maybe 1 minute between those, you know, because the second you send out the one thing and it doesn't mention her, then everybody's like, why isn't he endorsing her? Which is exactly what happened. You were talking about being on the air when it happened. That's exactly what happened on the air on MSNBC was, where's this going? I remember I was on right after it happened and before the endorsement came. And I said, look, I don't think there's any way he doesn't end up endorsing her, because I went through all the sort of mental calculations of where people would line up and what the destructiveness of the Democratic Party leadership trying to skip over Kamala Harris, Black woman vice president, who had the support of the Congressional Black Caucus and the very vocal support of the Congressional Black Caucus. But this is how crazy it was. Biden calls Clyburn to ask him about it. He says, I got this statement that he's going to leave the race. He's like, I got this statement. And Clyburn's like, it's a great statement, Mr. President, but it doesn't mention Kamala Harris. Where's Kamala Harris? Mike's like, oh, I'll get to her. You know, we'll do two statements. And then Clyburn's like, well, hurry up and put your statement out, because I need to endorse her, because he had this 5 o'clock call with Obama that day.
Right.
30 call in the evening. And this is like, this is, and Clyburn's like, Obama's going to try to rope me into this you know, open primary, open convention idea.
Yeah.
And I need to endorse her first so that by the time I get on the phone with him, he can't, you know, cajole me into doing it. So that's what happens. They end up having a 1-minute phone conversation where Clyburn's like, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I already endorsed her. My hands are tied. Nice talking to you. and you should get behind the vice president. But like all of this insanity going on behind the scenes, I think you're right, Michael. There's a lot of discomfort with Kamala Harris as the candidate, you know, particularly from Obama, mm-hmm. who wanted to his fingerprints off of it, and from Pelosi, who, you know, I think in a lot of ways had more courage than anyone else, because I think she had to get out, and it was happening more slowly than she would have liked, and a lot more slowly than a lot of the members of Congress would have liked and the candidates would have liked, because they were worried he was going to pull them down, and nobody would say it. And she didn't outright call for him to leave the race, but there were several times during that 24 days where she just kind of did a little public push.
I was going to say, the reality is she is in the most untenable position possible as the sitting vice president. She cannot go to the president and go, dude, you need to step down, because that is all self-interest, right?
It benefits her.
It benefits her, and reporters like you two sitting there will be chomping at the bits, trying to go after all of this, just trying to, you know, pull the pieces apart, and it just creates a nightmare. So she's off the table. The question, Amy, is the party has to come to the realization that you have an elderly gentleman who's showing his age. I don't think Joe Biden was so much cognitively impaired as he was just impaired by age, right?
Yeah.
I've been in space with the man. I've had conversations with the man, and every time, you walk away and go, yeah, he old as shit. But that doesn't mean he couldn't. I've walked away from Donald Trump saying, you know, he's crazy as fuck. So I'd rather have old as shit as opposed to crazy as fuck sitting down in 1600. All right. That for me was the essence of both the 16 and 20, the 20 and the 24 elections.
Yeah.
But Michael, why should Democratic voters settle for, you know, my guy is better than the other guy, or my woman is better than the other guy or woman? Like, they should be like, they should be able to find somebody that they can put out there that shares their values, that is like, you know, gangbusters.
Well, that's why I said 2023 was so important, because you know this. You're looking at the arc here. First off, your messaging is all off to begin with. Second of all, you've got a candidate that at some point becomes very clear he doesn't want to move on, but yet everyone around him knows he should. And nobody has figured out, A, how to deal with that, B, how to deal with Kamala, and C, more importantly, to your point, putting forward a candidate who could then stand up against Trump in a way in which you could actually hold those 7 battleground states. Yeah. Because that was always a crapshoot, Amy, for the Democrats.
Yeah, and we report in this book how Biden was trying to undermine, his people were trying to undermine Kamala Harris in those final days.
Talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were sending notes to donors, emails, which John and I have reviewed, basically saying, if you kick him out of the race, you're going to be left with her. Which is amazing when you think about it. I mean, this is his.
Biden is drowning Harris in order to keep his head above water when it is clear to everyone else he's not going to make it downriver.
No, because that boat's got a gaping hole in it.
Yeah. Oh, and this is coming from his personal team. I mean, it's astounding.
It's crazy. And
they put it in emails, the texts. I mean, there's electronic records of it. As Amy said, we reviewed some of this stuff. These messages are like so clear of Biden people being like, Kamala Harris is an absolute disaster. If you do that, you know, everything goes to shit.
And, well, look, they kept her on lockdown for the first 2 years.
Right.
And then, right. And then gave her these god-awful assignments. We need you to go be the border czar as well as deal with all the black people in the country. Oh, and by the way, when you get a chance, could you go to Europe and do a little foreign policy too?
Right. They do all this. They do all this negative messaging on her. You know, I mean, there's a term for that culturally. You know, like when a man you know, makes a woman feel bad about herself, and that's basically what the Biden White House did to Kamala Harris for a couple of years, and then you know, which is insane on the level of they know that if somebody takes over for Biden at some point, it's going to be her. And that he has put her in a position to potentially run after him, even if he doesn't run. And they just beat the heck out of her, right? Like, constantly making things. And look, presidents always give vice presidents bad, you know, bad gigs. But there was no support from inside the White House for her. And then it turns into them trashing her to all the people that she's going to need to raise money from, that she's going to need to get to vote for her. And it's no wonder that when she, you know, that by the time she gets out of the, you know, out there and campaigning, she's not 100% confident in herself because she's spent all this time getting trashed by her own people.
Doing the inside fight. We are talking about fight inside the wildest battle for the White House with John Allen, Amy Parnes. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. There's more, people. Let me just, there's so much more. We'll be right back. Vacation season is nearly upon us, folks. So this year, I'm treating myself to the top-of-the-line upgrades I deserve with Quince's high-quality travel essentials at fair prices. Now, I can snag killer luxury essentials that work with my vibe and will work for your wallet, like lightweight shirts and shorts from $30, pants for any occasion, and comfortable lounge sets. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I know you will too. I got the most beautiful scarves from Quince this past winter, and now it's time to get to look great for vacation fun. Their style is wonderful, their quality is amazing, and the price is just right. And you too can experience this. So for your next trip, treat yourself to the luxe upgrades you deserve. Go to quince.com/steal for 365-day returns, plus free shipping on your order. That's quince.com/steal to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/steal.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Welcome back, everybody. It's the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm having fun with my buddy, John Allen. He and I have a long history together. Gosh, I think probably going back to, shortly after I left, got to the RNC or before, man.
First time I talked to you, I'll never forget this. I hope I could say it now because it might have been on background at the time, but. I don't think it's a big.
Go ahead, dude. You're talking to me.
So I think the first time I talked to you was about redistricting in Maryland after the 2000 census, when you were the Republican state party chairman,
and we were planning to sue Glenn Denning and the state for their redistricting plan, and I teamed up with the county executive. here in Prince George's County, and we had a fun time, man. And we won the suit, so brother knows a little bit of how to do these things.
So I guess we got a 25 year anniversary, Michael.
We do.
I've known you longer than my wife.
That-
Well, longer than I've known my wife. I don't know how
long. Right, exactly. Well, that means cigar and suburban. That's what I'm thinking. And sounds maybe good. A steak to do it. Amy, you can come and referee for us because we're going to need it. We're going to need it. Two boys get wild. I have not had the pleasure of getting to know Amy for as long as John, but I'm very happy that she's a part of this conversation and teamed up with my buddy on this great book. That we've been discussing, Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. So Amy, let's get a little bit more into some of the good weeds, to paraphrase, the idea of good trouble. Talk about the attempts of Obama and Nancy Pelosi to do two things. One, to push Biden out, and yeah. Two, keep Kamala from getting on the stage.
Yeah.
And that must have been very, very interesting for Barack Obama as a Black man doing that to a Black woman, I'm just saying, for the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, and this is reported for the first time in Fight, but basically what we found out that Obama is sort of taking a backseat role. He's not as vocal as Nancy Pelosi is. You know, she's out there on Morning Joe. She's out there really forcing the hand. He's kind of calling around and he's talking to the president himself. And, you know, he's saying, you know, he in the very Obama way that he does, he's like, what's your plan, Joe? What are you, you know, he's trying to get some answers from him. He's not telling him to leave the race. But he's also talking to Pelosi, which we reveal for the first time. You know, they have a couple of calls and they're trying to figure out what to do with Biden and what to do with the party. You know, they both think that Kamala Harris can't win. And so they are kind of hearing, you know, testing the waters on this mini primary idea, which a lot of people at the time were saying was very far-fetched. You know, how can you mm-hmm. run a mini primary? How can you do an open convention? But I think they both thought from the outset that she couldn't win. And so they were trying to figure out what to do next. And what's interesting, I think, is just how they're maneuvering. I mean, like I said, she's doing it in a very public way. And she's listening to a lot of people, too. She's on the floor of the House talking to people. She's gathering information. She's worried about what's going to happen in the House, mostly. And she's also kind of, you know, giving, like, filtering the information and at the same time telling people what she's hearing and what she thinks is best. And I think all along, you know, she thought, if Biden goes, she said at one point to someone, if he goes, she goes. And that was sort of her view of that moment.
Pelosi harbored doubts about Biden's viability before the debate. Now with the donors, lawmakers in her ear, those doubts swelled. With a wounded candidate at the top of their ticket, Democrats wouldn't be able to turn out voters for down ballot candidates. That didn't turn out to be exactly true. If you know anything about how the game is played, it does. It's more bottom up than top down. And that's pretty much how I won in 2010. I didn't focus on, oh, I got to win the the congressional seat or the Senate seat. No, I need to win that state legislative seat because people vote bottom up.
Right.
And so that's a fundamental misunderstanding of how elections work at the grassroots level. So their premise was off to begin with, so just to connect the dot for folks, which is why I said at the beginning of our conversation in talking about that debate, what was missed, in my view, was the fact that Joe Biden did not hemorrhage his base on debate night after that debate. If they had been smart and followed the Republican playbook, as you saw the Republicans do around Access Hollywood, as you saw the Republicans do around Mexicans are murderers and thieves, and as you've seen Republicans do all the way up to January 6th, is we lock and load around our guy. We don't give them up to the wolves being the political opposition. the Democrats did that, and they do that. And instead of saying, hey, bad debate, dude, you know, he's almost 80. What can I say? The other guy's 78. What do you want me to do about that? He had a bad night. He's our guy. It's over by Monday. Trust me, it's over by Monday. But the reality of it is, because that base was locking around him, but because they were more anchored by the media and political class in Washington, that drove the narrative more so than anything else. But what you two write is that's the surface shit. It's what was going on beneath the surface that would not allow that coalescence around Joe Biden after that debate, that instead of closing in to lock it down, they saw that as a moment to open it up to push him out. And at the fundamental core of that stood two people to whom, quick query, update, has Joe Biden had a conversation with either of these two people since he left the White House?
They did, but a very kind of two very perfunctory conversations, one with Nancy Pelosi at the White House Christmas party, you know, a holiday picture.
Right.
And so
that's before he leaves the White House, but yeah, after the election.
Yeah.
Right.
And with Obama, you know, there was a story coming out, we were told, and aide said that they wanted to be able to say in the story that they had communicated. So they kind of brought them together, but you know, there's no love lost right now.
I mean, we have this anecdote in the book, Michael. I mean, this is incredible. 8 days after Joe Biden gets out of the race, he's on Air Force One flying to Texas. I believe it's for Sheila Jackson Lee's
funeral
or memorial mm-hmm. service. And he's on the plane with him are some of his closest allies. He's got Jim Clyburn's one of them, Chris Coons, the senator from Delaware, who sits mm-hmm. in the seat that Biden once held, and Al Sharpton. And Biden is saying to them, you know, he's very appreciative of them sticking with him, of none of them calling for his ouster. And he looks at Sharpton and he says, you know, Al, you stuck with me, you know, through thick and thin. And I thank you for that. And Sharpton says, well, I was glad to do it. And Biden says, you know, I'll never forget it. And he goes, and now here's who I will never forgive.
Mm.
Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
I mean, that relationship is dead. And I got to say, I mean, I think that was something that she, look, both of them saw themselves as the savior of democracy.
Yeah.
In the Trump era, right? For Pelosi, it was, you know, it was winning the House in 2018. It was doing the impeachments. It was making sure the certification of the 2020 election happened after January 6th, but on the same day, and coordinating with Mike Pence and Mitch yep. McConnell and Chuck Schumer to make sure that happened. And for Biden, it was winning in 2020 and ending the Trump term. And so that for a long time, they were both able to claim sort of credit on the Democratic side for this idea that they had really saved America from Donald Trump. And so there was room for both of them to have that view. And at some point, Nancy Pelosi stopped believing that the country needed to be saved by Joe Biden and that the country needed to be saved from Joe Biden. And once that happened, once that happened, their relationship was over.
How the hell do you come? See, this is the part that this is why your book, on the one hand, for me, is just so, it's just popcorn. Folks, I'm telling you, this is going to be such a great late spring, early summer read. Trust me, you're going to have the drink. You're going to have the popcorn. You're going to be laid out.
They might need therapy. They might need some therapy.
That's why you have the drink, baby. That's why you have instant therapy right there. Because the frustration, do you know who the fuck is running on the other side? Do you have any idea who's the opposition here? And yet you're trying to save the country from Joe Biden? Do you know how many Republicans like myself cross the line to support your dumbass party?
Well, I think
Price, and you guys are doing all kinds of fuckery in the background. to screw it up and not pay attention to the shit we're putting on the table to help you not beat your own dumb ass? Do you have any idea what the value of the proposition of 2024 was about? Oh, you don't, bitch? Well, guess what? Look around your dumb ass now. You're sitting there in the minority at all three levels, can't do jack shit. And then you got Chuck Schumer up there talking about some, well, let's go ahead and give the president the power to go ahead and, to avoid a government shutdown. Oh, while he's raping and pillaging every department and agency and just firing indiscriminately. And now just picking citizens up off the street and hauling them off to fucking El Salvador. And for what? Some internal tribal bullshit between octogenarians? Are you kidding me? Sorry.
One of the things that was astounding to us.
Your book helped me do that.
One of the things that was astounding to us, Michael, is this like victory lap that Chuck Schumer has been taking, where he's like trying to take credit for pushing Biden out of the race when he was largely silent. And he was not the guy that did that. And he's like, look at me. Look how powerful and smart and brilliant I am that I forced Joe Biden out of the race. And he started talking to reporters about that in like August. Not only is it like laughable in its face in terms of like the level of truth, but also like, why would you want to take credit for that? Everybody else, the smart ones at least wanted their fingerprints away from the crime scene. Like, yeah. Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama did not want their fingerprints on that shit.
Yeah.
But Chuck Schumer's I got it.
Amy, what are we doing here? What is this? I mean, why are they so bad at this?
That's the big question. I mean, that's what we were trying to figure out.
I think we got a lot of it. I think if you read this book, you will come away with a much greater understanding of who was running the Democratic Party in 2024.
So who was that? Who was running the Democratic Party?
Here's
an even better question. Before you get to that, because I want to go back to a point that Amy was making a little bit earlier about the fact you said they didn't think Kamala Harris could win. Why?
I mean, look at how it's amazing to me. I remember sitting in the arena at the Democratic convention and with all the bluster around Kamala and, all the vibe was there. But I was thinking just a few months ago, I mean, this is Kamala Harris. A few months ago, no, people would have laughed at this moment. They would have said, really? She's the candidate? She's the nominee? No one thought she was up for the job to begin with. And here she is. She finds herself on this, on the main stage.
Why did Biden pick her?
If we go into this in our previous.
I asked the question. I'm trying to give it. I'm feeding it to you.
We want you to buy this book now, but you can also buy the past one, or Amy can just tell you why he picked her. Which we covered in the last book.
I mean, he picks her because
the salesman over here.
We have a great scene in our last book, Lucky, about Jim Clyburn. And Jim Clyburn is essentially telling her that he wanted Joe Biden to pick a black Supreme Court justice, but he also was very big in pushing Kamala Harris. They thought that black women would, gravitate to her, they would support her. And he really wanted to pick someone else. He had his eyes on Gretchen Whitmer.
Amy Klobuchar would have been the better fit for him all around for a whole host of reasons. But I get Gretchen. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, and he had this whole battle.
Took himself out of the race.
Yeah. Yeah.
And said he ought to pick a black woman during the George Floyd protests, right? So there was a pressure from, externally to do that as well.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
So Kamala Harris is there. You've got these dynamics that are happening right now. Let's rewrite the story a little bit. Let's say Biden, or everything up to Biden's resignation happens, but he doesn't do an endorsement. They have a mini convention, or they have a mini primary. What were you hearing at that time in putting together the story? Because I know you got pieces of that potential story too, because there were people who thought that shit out. They had to think it out. So how do you think that play would have played out?
We report on this too in the book. I mean, I think that there's a couple things to remember. Number one, Biden had 90% of the delegates pledged to him. And by the way, those delegates also were pledged to Kamala Harris, at least as the vice presidential candidate. Some of them certainly would have peeled away, but a lot of them would have stuck with her. And I think the consensus is that if they'd had an open convention, the most likely outcome is that Kamala Harris wins that after a shit ton of blood is spilled on the floor. Right? Like, where you've got, I mean, we know from...
It would have been a fight.
We know from a women's congressional Democratic text thread on the night of the debate. All these Democratic women members of Congress are on a chain together, and they're watching the debate, and Hillary Scolton, a freshman from Michigan, in the middle of the debate, or like right after, a text, Whitmer for president. And then another person jumps in and says same thing, Whitmer for president. And then members of the Congressional Black Caucus, women in the Congressional Black Caucus, start pushing back and going, Harris for president. They're not even stopping on debate night to say, stick with Joe. They're like, no, fuck you. You're not sticking your nose in here and getting Gretchen Whitmer going. You're not stepping over Kamala Harris, right? So you see that fight engage on day one. And really it was a leftover, or like a continuation of what had happened in 2020. You know, Whitmer and Harris had been kind of pitted against each other, and there was a lot of backbiting. In fact, one of the people familiar with this said that Harris had done a lot of like dark arts stuff against Whitmer, and Whitmer had felt the burn of that so badly. Yeah. And it felt touched up, meaning like she felt like she'd been scarred in the eyes of a lot of black elected officials because
she was campaigning against her.
Right. And some voters too, right? Because there was this campaign against this kind of behind the scenes campaign against her. And so much so that a few days after the debate, Gretchen Whitmer calls Kamala Harris, never before reported until our book. Calls Kamala Harris and says, I just want you to know I'm not running for president under any circumstances.
Wow.
Which was not an endorsement of Harris if Biden got out, but it sure was. There's no need for you to start beating my ass again because...
Right.
Because I'm not running.
I'm not in it.
I'm not your rival. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
You watch that develop over the course of several weeks, and it becomes clear that there is no way that the Democrats are going to skip over Kamala Harris, even if there's an open convention. And the blood that would be left on the floor, let's say that happened. I mean, what happens to the key, most core Democratic base over the years, which is Black women? Black women vote for Democrats at a higher rate than any group, and by far, and are activists in the party.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's destructive to the Democratic Party.
And let's remember where they were at that moment. They were so scared. They were already fractured. And then they were going to go into an open convention and fight each other there. Everyone was scared of that moment, with the exception of maybe Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama.
Who were like, no, that's what we want to do. Let's do that. Let's do more self-destruction and immolation. So two things before I let you guys jump. One is, okay, reveal the true nature of President Biden's declining health.
I mean, it's quite stunning, Michael, what we've revealed in this book. I mean, we have people like Eric Swalwell, who comes into contact with Biden a year before in 2023 at a congressional picnic, and Biden doesn't remember who he is. And this is a guy who he ran against in 2020, you know, rank and file member, but pretty high profile rank and file member, He should know who he is. The old Biden in the old days would have known who he was and would have chatted him up. But, you know, we have other moments in the book where he's aimlessly, you know, giving a tour of around the White House. Kevin McCarthy's along for the ride and feels the need to kind of almost chaperone him because he's wandering aimlessly, even though Jill Biden is telling him not to do this. Around the White House, giving people a tour of the locker room and all the stuff that, you know, no one really cares about. And we have more anecdotes about the optics around his age and how he would have to meet with a makeup artist when he was traveling, first order of business every day. It goes on and on and on.
And not for TV, Michael, but to do Zoom calls with his staff, right? Like they were, the White House, the tight cocoon around him was very concerned about how he appeared, not just to the broader public, but even to people internally in the administration.
With his own staff.
Yeah.
And as far as age-related decline goes, I mean, as anybody who's had a, you know, an elderly parent or somebody that they've been close to that where you see those signs of age or, you know, like I'm not a doctor, I can't possibly diagnose anything, but it's not linear.
No.
But over time, you know, the cumulative effect becomes more clear. And I think that's true with Biden. What we heard from people who were close to him was particularly in the first several months of 2024, there was a precipitous decline in his in the frequency of his acuity or a real increase in how often he seemed out of it.
What role did Dr. Jill Biden not play in that she should have played?
She probably should have told her husband, as you suggested earlier, you know, she probably should have said, you know, we did it. You always wanted to be president. Now it's time to pass the torch. Yeah.
He said he was going to be a bridge. And I know people quarrel about, you know, did he say that he was only going to run for one term? He didn't say he was going to only run for one term, but he certainly heavily implied it in 2020. And swing voters heard it that way. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think he meant that he was going to be a bridge from one Trump term to the second Trump term. And, you know, as far as Jill Biden goes, I mean, you know, you would hope that if you were in that position, your spouse would, you know, try to protect your reputation. I mean, at the end, the way that Joe Biden was treated by his party and the way that that he brutal. Sort of went out was, yeah, it's brutal. And you know, I don't think he deserved that. His, you know, his sins are of ego for sure. No question.
Yeah.
His sins are common to wanting to hold on to power. Sort of character flaws that are kind of common to people who run for president of the United States.
Right.
That's nothing terribly new. But like, you know, I mean, nobody, Trump felt some level of sympathy for him when they were on the debate stage. I mean, if you go back and watch that debate and you see Trump kind of back off a little bit.
He does. It was a really interesting moment. I don't know if a lot of people saw, but I agree with you. He did ease off the gas and did not take the openings that Biden was giving him at that.
And
at the,
even if it was
middle to the end of that debate.
And even if that was performative, I mean, you know, Trump had a sense that like at least the optics of it were, you know, something he didn't want to take advantage of. We report in the book for the first time, you know, what he was thinking as he's watching Biden and what his thought is, how do I keep hitting this guy without coming off as an asshole?
Yeah.
Everybody thinks I'm an asshole.
Which is saying something for the asshole. So, yeah.
Right. And he thinks, and he's like, people think I'm going to go off the rails. I need to rein it in here. I mean,
this
is not the Trump that we are used to seeing that we saw on that debate stage that night. And I think it's because even after all these years of saying Biden lacked acuity, and after all these years of saying he would kick Biden's ass, he was surprised by the level of what he saw.
So, final point, Amy, you both touched on Biden as the bridge to the next generation. What does that next generation look like as we stand on the precipice of congressional elections next year? And a presidential election in, 2 years after our 250th anniversary.
I mean, I think Democrats, for starters, need to come to some sort of reckoning. And you're not really, you're seeing a little bit of that, Michael, but not really a lot of it. And for starters, they should start with Joe Biden. You know, there is this lack of acceptance about what went on and mm-hmm. what they allowed to carry on. You know, we saw that play out this week in an interview with Tim Walz. He didn't want to talk about it. But they almost need to look themselves in the mirror and admit they have they're an alcoholic and admit that they have a problem. And for whatever reason, they don't want to do that. And I think that's the first step of many steps for this party to go forward.
Amy and I have 12 of them, 12 of those steps, I think, that we can help guide people through. I think if you see the seeds of this in the book, but I should say it again, Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. But I think for the Democrats, like, look, the midterms are different than the next presidential election.
I think
the midterms, you know, being against Trump if he is seen as overreaching is a big part of the equation. And it doesn't mean fighting him on everything. I think if you fight on everything, it doesn't suggest that there's, you know, one thing that you stand for. If you prioritize everything, you don't prioritize anything. But the other thing I would say about that is when Democrats are looking for their next candidate, like, the Democratic Party needs at some point to offer a forward-looking vision of a modern America. You know, Trump's forward-looking vision is actually a backward-looking vision, but it has the feel of sounding new. And the advantage of sounding new and the advantage of
that's largely, Jonathan, because they haven't heard anything, to your point, that would say that sounds old, Mr. Trump, because this sounds new coming from Democrats.
Right. And so where is the Democrat that's going to go out there and touch some of the third rails that's going to say, look, this is a sacred cow for my party. But if we want to save these programs, if you're a Democrat, you should be saying, like, the whole thing for the last several years has been about saving democracy. If you want to save democracy, if you want people to believe in democracy, then the swing voters and the people who are largely disengaged from politics but show up on election day and presidential elections, they have to believe that democracy is working for them, that's working for their pocketbook, that it's working for their retirement, that it is working for their health care. And the Democrats need to have a vision for the future that says, here's how we're going to address these problems going forward. And they have not had that in a long time. There has not been a refresh. Much of what they do is, how do we protect X, Y, and Z?
Well, yeah, there's a lot there. And folks, it's all in Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House by Jonathan Allen, Amy Parnes. I'm telling you, get your favorite adult beverage, found a lounge chair and some popcorn, because this was a good one. You're going to enjoy it. I've enjoyed the conversation. I hope you guys have as well. Thank you both so much coming in. Back the onion a little bit for us. And as we see, there are always some more layers. And at each layer, you cry just a little bit more.
Thank you, Michael. Looking forward to celebrating our 25th anniversary of knowing each other with a cigar.
Yes, indeed, dude. I am excited for that. And like I said, you may have to be there just because the fellas may need a referee. We appreciate you guys so much. Thank you all for taking some time to spend with us to talk with Amy and with Jonathan about Fight. Get a copy of it now, share it with your friends. It is a very intriguing, insightful story about one of the wildest rides for the White House in modern history. Until next time, guys, just take it easy out there. You know, we're getting ready into the late spring, early summer. You know what it is. You got to get in that good bikini, you know, swim trunk shape. Do that, but, you know, don't do it with stupid. Because that's not good. I'm telling you every time to stay away from stupid. Till next time, God bless.
Hi. Hi, I'm John Fugelsang.
And I'm Professor Corey Brettschneider.
And we are here to tell you about The Oath and the Office, an essential new podcast about the extremely strange times we find ourselves in.
In the first few seconds in office, the President of the United States is required to take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And we're going to hold him to that pledge, despite the fact that he has threatened democracy and even the law itself.
It's all about hope for what democracy should look like and getting real about what our democracy does look like from an esteemed constitutional scholar and a deeply unqualified comedian.
Subscribe to The Oath and the Office wherever you get your podcasts.